Mass protests spread across Iran. It's Thursday, September 22nd, and this is Hear It Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. The crowd we heard a moment ago was chanting, "I'll kill the one who killed my sister," a reference to Mahsa Amini, who died in police custody in Iran last week. Protests have spread to dozens of cities, and there are now reports of multiple deaths following a crackdown by police. Nagar Mortazavi is an Iranian-American journalist. She spoke to Here and Now's Robin Young.
This is about the death of the 22-year-old Mahsa Amini. We've seen grainy video of her on some security camera collapsing in some sort of holding room. Who is she? How did she get there?
Yes, Robin. So what we know is that she was a 22-year-old woman, Kurdish woman, originally from the Kurdish area in western Iran, who was visiting Tehran with her family and riding the metro. When she gets off, she is stopped by this morality police, or as they're literally called, the guidance police, to be guided for how she was dressed. And then eventually detained, arrested by them, and taken to the detention center where women and some men are taken for further guidance. And then she dies in police custody. The video is not very clear because it's edited, it's cut, it's not continuous. We don't see the entire process of what happened to her. And her family was saying that she's a young woman, she was healthy, she didn't have underlying conditions. The state is trying to defy responsibility, saying she suddenly collapsed. But I think what's important here in the fact is that she died in police custody. Yeah. So the responsibility for her well-being and her life lies with them.
Well, but tell us more about these morality police, guidance police. It's chilling. I mean, it's Handmaid's Tale. And in the video, she appears to be covered. Her hair appears to be covered. What is it that they do?
Exactly. So the morality police or the guidance police is part of the largest police force. They have the same authority as regular police to arrest people. Well, initially, they're supposed to guide people as to how they're supposed to be dressed and behave, which also turns to be very subjective. It's not a very clear mandate. It's not very clear for people how they stop, who they pick on. And that's what we're also hearing from many religious Iranians, essentially asking what exactly was wrong with her dress, with her appearance, that led to her arrest and eventually her death. So the morality police is now, by many Iranians, seen as a form of violent harassment against Iranians in the public. And what I find significant and incredible is that now we have religious Iranians calling for the abolishing of this police and saying, don't do this in the name of our religion, our beliefs. We are religious. Some hijabi women online were saying, I am hijabi, but I oppose the morality police.
Well, you know, but these kind of heart-lifting uprisings against the tyrannical regime in Iran have historically not ended well, at least in recent history. There was the 2009 Green Movement. In 2019, there were protests over fuel prices, democracy, calls for an overthrow of the government. There was a crackdown. Many died. Internet blackouts then. You know, at that time, too, and, you know, both times, there was sort of a, why didn't the West, why didn't someone come to help us and support us? But what is the government, you know, trying to do now, and is it seen as not working?
Well, you know, the government or the state also reacts to these protests with a lot of violence and force. In 2009, as you mentioned, that was the largest protest since the 1979 revolution. Millions of Iranians took to the streets and they stayed for about a year. And the state used a lot of violence, security forces, to crack down on the protests. Again, in 2019, when the hike in fuel prices sparked a lot of protests nationwide, the state literally used an iron fist. Hundreds of protesters were killed on the street. Thousands were arrested. And they cracked down. This time around, also, we're seeing security forces using a lot of violence, force. There's already reports of a number of protesters being killed on the street. Unfortunately, I expect it to be higher, and we're going to see more violence. There's also reports of internet shutdowns, limiting of social media use, which would limit not only protesters coordinating and connecting with each other, but also that connection to the outside world, sending out images, evidence. And unfortunately, it's a sign of more crackdown and repression to come.
Well, and we should mention, too, that many female journalists, such as yourself, even there in D.C., are facing, you know, threats online in your case, threats of abuse. It's tough.
It's very much, unfortunately, it is. And especially when you're doing objective reporting, as you also know, the job, and trying to bring nuance, fair and objective and nuanced views to the issue. The attacks sometimes come from all corners. It's just making our life and our job so much more difficult. But, you know, I still believe in what I do, and I try to do it for the women who are standing up in Iran so courageously.
Well, I have to say, out of respect for you, I do not know what it's like to be an Iranian journalist. So thank you so much, Iranian-American journalist Nigar Mortazavi, for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
After the break, the Fed raised interest rates again. What does it mean for you?
Price increases have ballooned so much this year that even a few casual dates a month quickly eats into what's left of my budget.
Listener Abraham Martinez told us last month that inflation was hurting his love life. Ouch. We also heard about the crunch people are feeling from the rising cost of groceries, housing, and childcare. Well, the Federal Reserve's response to all that economic pain is to introduce some pain of its own. Here's how Fed Chair Jerome Powell put it.
If we want to set ourselves up, really, really light the way to another period of a very strong labor market, we have got to get inflation behind us. I wish there were a painless way to do that. There isn't.
Yesterday's interest rate hike was the third one this year. But what exactly does that mean for you? Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd asked MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi to explain.
It's not just the third hike, it's the third hike of 0.75 percentage point, right? The Fed normally moves in 0.25 percentage point increments. It's like a big deal if they cut or raise by 0.5 percentage point. They've moved 3 times 0.75 percentage point. So it's almost the equivalent of 9 interest rate hikes.
Well, to that point, how much longer do you think the Fed realistically will be forced to raise these rates?
Well, so the good news is, if it can be described as good news, the Fed rate is about 3.25%, which means the prime rate, which is what banks charge their best customers, is about 6.25%, which is about the same as what a 30-year mortgage would be. Now, much, much higher than it was a year ago when you can get a mortgage for 3% for a 30-year fixed mortgage, but much lower than the 14 and 15% it was in the 80s. So the Fed still has room to go, and Jerome Powell has indicated that until inflation is under control, they may continue to increase interest rates. So I don't know how long it'll take because it's not science, it's art, right? At some point, someone says, costs too much to borrow money, costs too much to buy a house, costs too much to run a balance on my credit card, so I'm going to pull back. The pulling back is what slows inflation down. The danger, of course, is the pulling back is also what slows the economy down. And if you do it too much, it becomes a recession.
You use this example of the mortgage rates, right? This is very important because this is where the money really becomes clear and obvious. If you get a loan on a $500,000 house with a 6% interest rate today, you're going to pay nearly $900 more every month compared to about a year ago. Ali, that's significant for people.
That's huge. That's huge. And that's exactly right. So mortgages are the biggest deal. Cars are, generally speaking, people's second biggest investment. Now we've had inflation. So car prices, if you're looking for one, used or new, are up and your loan will be a lot more. And then, of course, there's credit card. Credit card debt is the highest level, not credit card rates, not debt, but credit card interest rates, if you carry a balance, are at the highest level they've been at since 1996, and they're probably still going up. So now this is a problem. If you're living on the edge and you've got a car payment and maybe a house payment and credit card debt, suddenly your life that you were living 6 months ago is substantially more expensive than it was then. And for some people, enough to tip them into difficulty, not making payments. And of course, then your credit card or your car loan rates or your mortgage goes up. You could lose your home. So this is why we have to think about this in a very important way. For people living on the edge, living from paycheck to paycheck, this is very difficult.
Well, when you lay it out this way, you really can see how the interest rate situation might slow down the economy. And if and when it does slow down so much that we enter into a recession, what do you think that looks like?
Well, the good news is that of late, our recessions tend to bounce back pretty fast. What the Fed is trying to do is figure out how much can we increase rates by to cool the economy without cooling it off too much. The problem is there's a lag effect, right? They raised interest rates yesterday. They'll do it again. You don't see the effect the next day. People don't pay off their credit cards the next day. They don't stop their purchases. They don't sell their car. They don't change their behavior in housing. Could take 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. So the problem is if you keep increasing interest rates and you don't know what 18 months ahead looks like, you could overdo it. So it becomes very, very hard to calculate what to do at this point. The Fed was hoping inflation would sort of calm itself down when energy prices came down and supply chain issues were worked out, but it hasn't done that. And by the way, this is a global issue, and America's not even in the worst spot on all of this. So whatever the Fed does also depends on what the rest of the world does. For the moment, by the way, every time the Fed increases, the UK increases, the European Central Bank increases, the Canadians increase. So the world's sort of approaching this in exactly the same way, hoping that these interest rate increases will slow the economy down.
Butterfly flaps its wings, they say. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you very much.
Thanks, Peter.
Coming up, how to speak whale.
I can visualize it now. I just remember it. It was very straightforward. I just thought, there's a whale in the air above me and it's going to land on me and that means I'm going to die now.
In 2015, filmmaker Tom Mustel was kayaking in Monterey Bay, California, when a humpback whale leapt out of the ocean and crashed down onto his boat. The whale's impact plunged the kayak underwater, taking Tom and his friend Charlotte with it. The kayak popped back up to the surface, and when they emerged, Tom and Charlotte were shocked to realize they were both alive. Now Tom has written a book called How to Speak Whale, and he told Peter O'Dowd that that brush with death inspired him to learn more about these magnificent animals.
As the whale came down onto me and Charlotte in the kayak, I flipped the kayak over. And then I think just waited for the impact of the whale on my body, because the last thing I'd seen, it was coming directly towards me and was just going to land straight on us. But it didn't, and neither of us were killed or even injured at all. And I couldn't make sense of that. And then some biologists looked at the footage, and one in particular, Professor Joy Rydenburg, she studies the body movements of whales. And she said that the whale changed its course in midair and avoided us. And she felt that it was trying to not hit us.
Well, what do you make of that interpretation then? Do you think there was some sort of, I don't know if communication is the right word, but some sort of human-whale interaction that was happening in that flash of a moment?
As a biologist by background and as a filmmaker who's taught to not project human characteristics onto other species, all my training said, no, it was just an accident and there was no thinking behind it. But in the course of researching the book, I learned some things that have made me reconsider that initial response. One is that they are incredibly sophisticated in the structure of their brains, which leads us to think that they have advanced cognition. And there's this other thing, which is that humpback whales will go out of their way to stop other whales, dolphins, seals, and sometimes even giant ocean sunfish getting hurt, specifically being hunted by killer whales.
So you're saying that the humpback would stop a sunfish from getting hunted by an orca or something like that? Is that what you're referring to?
It sounds extraordinary, but this has been recorded again and again. There are examples of whales having associations, like different cetaceans, whales and dolphins, with different species, like friendships, you could potentially say, like social interactions that last a long time, traveling together, feeding together, playing together. So they seem to have, inverted commas, friendships across species. They seem to care about what happens to other species to the extent that they'll change their actions in their own lives.
So there's clearly something going on here. You had this near-death experience, which sets you on the path to find some answers, right? And one of the first people to bring whale sounds or vocalizations to the public was Roger Payne. In 1970, he released a hugely influential album of these sounds called Songs of the Humpback Whale. Let's listen to what that sounded like. Many people have heard that sound now. The recordings brought attention to the fact that at the time, whales were on the verge of extinction. But if you kind of look back now, what is it that we've learned from those tapes about whether or not the whales are communicating or able to communicate?
I think one of the first things that Roger found was that those sounds contained really complicated structures and patterns, and he related them to human music. You had phrases, you had rhythmic elements, but those sounds are just part of the repertoire of humpback whales, which make loads and loads of other sounds, and they seem to use those sounds to coordinate their social lives. They hunt together and they need to make sounds to help each other have roles in the different parts of the hunting that they do, or they teach their young where to go and how to forage for themselves. Since Roger made the discovery that they sing, really, what's been happening is that we've been gradually finding evidence of more and more vocalizations that whales and dolphins and other species of whales make, and that there's this whole universe in the sea of these animals communicating with one another with very complex, very varied sounds.
Well, right, and is it a language, right? I mean, that's the fundamental and controversial question.
It's a highly controversial question because, well, for many reasons. I mean, one of them is that what a language is has been disputed for a long time. One of the definitions is that only humans have language. I feel that rather than getting wrapped up in the term language and what it means for humans, I feel for most people to know that whales and dolphins have the capacity for things like having names, like each dolphin of some species as it's growing up will learn a specific sound that it makes itself. And the other dolphins, when it sees them make, and when they can be separated for decades and then reunited, they make those sounds again, like they're calling out each other's names.
Oh, and wow. Like, here I am, it's me.
It's me, yeah. I mean, and it makes sense. You need that in the sea. If you're teaming up with others in the sea and you can't see them because it's often dark or the visibility is bad and you're trying to figure out, is this an enemy? Is this a friend? Being able to understand who it is that's talking is very helpful.
Why don't we hear some more sound here? This is a recording that you sent us. It's a group of orcas. So much appears to be going on here. And in the book, you talk about the problems that scientists face as they try to decode all the different kinds of sounds that these animals make, right? There's a lot of noise going on. How do you sort through it?
I mean, it's really hard for a start. The scientist who sent me that called it an orca herring party. That was a whole family of orcas making loads of different sounds to each other as they were eating loads of fish. And it's made even more complicated because the orcas can actually make two different sounds at the same time. They can like sing duets with themselves. Mm. How do you know who's talking? How do you know who's responding? How do you know what's happening? Like, if you're going to try and have any way into finding out if there might be language-like meaning in those sounds, we've been, for most of our history, lost because we couldn't put them in a context. We couldn't record them often. We couldn't even figure out who said what, when they said it, and what happened next.
You say most of our history, though, but this is the crux of your book, right? There is a lot of new stuff happening right now that might blow the cover off of some of this, and that includes the role of artificial intelligence. What can AI do that humans, that our brains simply cannot do?
One is they can do many things that we can do, but they can do them 24 hours a day, day and night. They can listen through thousands of hours of recordings and identify when a whale is talking. And then the next thing they can do is they can do things that we cannot. Most of this branch of AI, machine learning, is what's called pattern recognition. There's branches of AI that are able to find patterns that no human could ever find. That includes patterns in communications, in language. And we've developed those tools in finding patterns in our language for tools like Google Translate. And so now the biologists are getting hold of these tools and they're using them to find invisible patterns that human biologists would never see in the communications of other species.
So we have these new tools, but how close are they getting us to the main goal here, which is to learn how to communicate with an animal like a whale well enough to exchange ideas?
We don't know yet. At the moment, we're just trying to take the first steps to get enough information that these machine learning, these AI techniques will work. But we don't know what we're going to find. It's like we've invented a telescope. We don't know what we're going to see through it. But we're just deciding to take this telescope and look at whales and dolphins.
Well, before we let you go, I want to listen to just one more bit of sound here. This is a humpback whale recorded in Glacier Bay, Alaska. Tom, you say in the book that the journey to discover whether whales might speak and think like us was more interesting and more complicated than you could have anticipated, and that every question you answered basically opened the door to another mystery. So I want to leave you with this. If that mystery were solved someday and you were in the water with the whale that we just heard, or maybe the whale that changed the course of your life, what would you want to say?
Oh, that's such a good question. So I've had the fortune of lying in the sea above a whale that was singing and feeling its voice resonate my whole body. And that experience changed and enriched my life so much, I would probably just say, thank you.
Tom Mustel's new book is How to Speak Whale, A Voyage into the Future of Animal Communication. Tom, what a book, what a story you have to tell. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on. Cheers.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. And we've actually got another podcast out right now, too. It's a 5-part series where Here and Now's Scott Tong investigates a scandal at the Environmental Protection Agency. In the 1980s, President Ronald Reagan's EPA administrator, who, by the way, was current Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch's mother, tried to gut the very agency she'd been appointed to lead.
Very, very, very few people were going to be left in their jobs. Lobotomy is not too strong a word for what they were planning.
That's Captured from Here and Now and WBUR Podcasts. Available right here in the Here and Now podcast feed, as well as on our website, hereandnow.org. Today's stories were produced by Thomas Danielian, Gabrielle Healy, and Emiko Tamagawa. Gabe Bullard, Todd Munt, and Tinker Ray edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Mike and Max are the theme music, too, along with me, Chris Bentley. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.